This week on Art on the Air featured President of the Northwest Indiana Forum, Heather Innes, and Public Sphere Project Strategic Planner, Philip Barish, discussing Ignite the Region Arts and Culture Survey. Next, photographer Joey Lax Salinas discusses his new illustrated book, Sweet Dreams, Northwest Indiana. Our spotlights on the expansion of facilities and class offerings at Chesterton Art Center.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. And is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. We'd like to welcome back to Art on the Air Spotlight from the Chesterton Art Center with a whole wide range of wonderful announcements about some things that are coming up, Hannah Hammond-Hegman. And she's going to tell us about everything that's going on there and some new news that we have for you. Hannah, welcome back to Art on the Air Spotlight.
Hi, guys. Hey, Larry and Esther. Good to see you, too. I am thrilled to be here with you right now with a big announcement that the Chesterton Arts Center has acquired additional property for our use. So we're doing in the midst of a large life-changing facility expansion. We have acquired additional property right across the street from our home here on 4th Street in downtown Chesterton. And we're just really, really excited about all the possibilities that additional space is going to bring for our programming, for our community. It's a big, big deal, and we're thrilled.
When do you go in to start renovating?
Now.
Now, good.
Bits and pieces are happening as we speak, and we're working with architects and contractors, and we're going to be renovating part of the property into two new classroom studios for the Art Center and for the community. So this is the space that was formerly the Chesterton Bicycle Station on 4th Street in downtown. And so, yeah, we're looking forward to opening the doors to those as classrooms in spring of 26.
What do you envision? What type of classes do you envision in there? Is there a particular purpose you have in mind?
Oh, absolutely. Dreams are happening. So there'll be two larger facilities, classroom facilities in there. One will be a dedicated ceramics studio, which will be amazing. And then we're going to be building out a second 2D studio. We'll move our printing press in there and have space for painting and drawing, figure work, all of that. But those classes will be fully accessible. The bathroom facilities will be fully accessible. So to be able to expand that kind of accessible space for the center is a huge deal as well. So welcome students of all ages.
Plus, it gives us more parking.
You know, sure.
I mean, you know, that's
ever important. I know.
If you're familiar with 4th Street there, it gives us a whole thing. And then, of course, if we do another outdoor gala, we'll have have both sides of the street covered.
It's going to be brilliant. We'll be able to close 4th
Street. It'll be good to move the ceramic studio out to a different building, and then you don't have to worry about all the ceramic dust on the art.
Exactly. And, you know, we'll be able to relocate the kiln into a space where it can fire whenever we need it to. But these types of spaces are going to really be able to professionalize the studio practices of our more advanced students as well. We'll be able to offer some independent studio time for artists who are really seeking that. So it'll change the face of our educational offerings. And we're just thrilled. We're really, really excited to be doing it.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
You're involved in something else that involves the arts and culture in Chesterton. Maybe you can tell us a little about that.
I would love to. So sometimes, you know, all of these things kind of happen on top of each other for a reason. So I'm part of a team here in Chesterton, and we're really thrilled that we now have a officially designated arts and cultural district that encompasses our thriving historic downtown, called the Chesterton Trackside Arts and Cultural District. This district encompasses Broadway to Calumet, as far north as Grant Avenue, south to Indiana Avenue. But we, you know, embarked on a 5-month community engagement process to really get input from the Chesterton community about meaningful assets, cultural, historical, things that mattered to the community. And so upon calling all of that data, we came up with this beautiful boundary district here for Chesterton that's going to uplift the arts and culture here, as well as small businesses and thriving organizations that make up who we are and make Chesterton such a unique destination. So stay tuned. There's going to be much more on that. We're working closely with other partners to market it and promote it. But the fact the town of Chesterton designated through town council resolution at the end of September. And it's a very exciting venture. And we're really excited about the initiative.
So Hannah, I read that you're putting a call out to artists to design unique sculptures and place markers. So how, you know, but I didn't notice in that prospectus how many you're looking for, how many markers, how many or sculptures?
It's a perfect question. And I think that that will depend on the design of that marker. Of course, we would love to, we need multiples of whatever it is so that they can be scattered throughout the district to have like a real visibility happen. You know, so as people are moving through, they'll be like, oh, there it is. And there it is. And we're still in the Trackside Arts and Cultural District. And it'll be part of, you know, a recognition that happens as you walk through or drive through. And so the specific number will be determined by the artist's intentions and the cost, obviously, of fabricating and installing those and the scale, right? So we're working
closely. What's your ideal, though? What would be your ideal?
At least 5, up to 8 to 10. Yeah.
Okay.
I think that, you know, we need to build some kind of placemaking through the multiple sculptures.
Real quick, in our last minute here, what's coming up at the Chesterton Arts Center in terms of exhibits?
Right. So in our galleries now in November, we're welcoming the Duneland Plein Air Painters Group, phenomenal group of local artists who always put on a really beautiful show. So yes. And then we roll into end of the year is our annual members exhibit. So come on down.
Thank you so much. That's the Chesterton Arts Center and the executive director, Hammond Hagman, and she's telling us all about the new facility that you're coming right across the street, and of course the branding leadership. Thank you for coming to Art of the Year Spotlight and sharing all this wonderful news.
Yeah, always exciting to hear what you're up to.
There's a lot.
And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art in the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Emberforge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. This is Pledge Week for your public radio station, and Art on the Air encourages our loyal listeners to support this station by making a monthly sustaining pledge so we may continue to bring you this great program.
This is Terry O'Reilly, host of Under the Influence, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Heather Ennis and Philip Barish to Art on the Air. Heather is president and CEO of the Northwest Indiana Forum, a privately held nonprofit organization focused on creating economic development opportunities for the seven-county region. Philip is a planning and placemaking expert working towards shaping more vibrant and just urban places. They are here to speak about Ignite, the region, Northwest Indiana's strategy for economic transformation, and READY, Regional Economic Development Initiative. Thank you both for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Heather and Philip. It's very nice seeing you again.
Well, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much. Excited to be here.
Well, we want to start off briefly with each of you telling us a little bit about your background. When I do this for a full interview, I say how you got from where you were to where you are now. But basically, we just want a quick thumbnail of each of that before we get into the guts of our interview. So, Heather, I'm going to have you go first.
Sure. So, I'm Heather Ennis. I'm president and CEO of the Northwest Indiana Forum. The Northwest Indiana Forum is the seven-county economic development organization. We cover Lake, Porter LaPorte, Jasper, Newton, Glasgow, and Stark counties. So, really lucky to get to work at the Northwest Indiana Forum. We act as the voice of Northwest Indiana business. We market Northwest Indiana as the place for business. And then we stake out and drive bold initiatives that wouldn't happen without the forum.
Excellent. And Philip, tell us a little bit about your background for our audience.
Well, Larry, I would love to do that, but I feel like Heather has not hyped herself up nearly enough.
I agree with that.
There's also... She's been a remarkable partner to work with on the arts and culture strategy in Northwest Indiana, and a really deeply informed and enthusiastic ambassador for the region. So, Heather, it's been a delight to work together.
So fun.
Yeah, it's true.
Tell us about yourself.
Sure. So my name is Philip Barish. As my introduction already alluded to, I'm an urbanist, an urban planner, and I serve as principal at Public Sphere Projects, which is an urban planning firm practicing nationally that really focuses on the intersection of the quality of place and its creativity and culture. So we've had the good fortune of working alongside Heather and other communities throughout Indiana and around the country on issues where cities, regions, districts are grappling with how to improve its quality of life and quality of place, often through arts, culture, and creativity.
Excellent. So I guess what we're going to move on to the heart of the issue is, and I'll start with Heather, is what was the initiative? And I know there was originally a five-pillar thing. We'll get into the six-pillar, which we went back to discover. But tell us about the initiative with what you want to do with this program.
Sure. So in 2018, we launched Ignite the Region, which is Northwest Indiana's strategy for economic transformation. That plan, when rolled out in 2018, really crafted a full regional plan. We, you know, the region hadn't had a full plan. We had a lot of great organizations doing amazing work, but doing it somewhat in silos, or as I like to say, cylinders of excellence. And so we rolled that plan out in 2018. We revamped it again in 2021, just really looking at opportunities to bring in more components to it. So business development, marketing, entrepreneurship and innovation, placemaking and talent were the five original pillars of Ignite the Region. And the great things that that plan did when we launched it in 2018, by the fall of 2020, we had 88% of that plan complete or in process. And so we used that to bring about some READY funding, $50 million of READY funding through READY Round 1. And then READY Round 2, we were able to garner another $45 million with that plan. But the READY Round 2 had some frosting on the cake with some Lilly endowment funds that really lent us to re-examine our planning and our strategy and really evaluate where arts and culture plays a role in this. Driving the creative economy and the creative culture is a critical component to our big ideas that was part of our READY 2 application. But we really didn't have strong strategy around how to do that or what that could look like. So we are really grateful to the Indiana Economic Development Corporation and the Indiana Arts Council when they came out and said, okay, let's really get a strategy and a plan together. So, and I said Indiana Arts Council and Indiana Arts Commission. Sorry about that.
I think they'll forgive you on that. So, Philip, where did you come in on this plan from the very beginning? And then I guess the second part of that question is, when did you realize that the sixth pillar was a missing component, and then how did you address that?
Yeah, we came into Northwest Indiana to work with Heather and her leadership team and the entire arts and culture sector almost a year ago now, 9+ months ago. And the initial trigger for that work, as Heather has already mentioned, was the pledge that Lilly Endowment made to fund arts and culture, to support arts and cultural activities throughout the state. But it wasn't entirely clear to us or to Lilly Endowment or to the Indiana Arts Commission or to Forum what arts and culture really means in that region. And that's an essential question for a variety of reasons. One of them is that philanthropy and economic development has to answer the essential question, which I'm sure that IAC and Lilly Endowment will also forgive me for saying this, but the problem of where to send the check.
Right.
The money has been pledged, but who do we send the check to really? And some arts and culture assets are pretty clear. When we talk about big A art, you know, opera, ballet, theater. But culture is so much more, especially in a region like Northwest Indiana.
Right.
It covers an entire continuum of activities from your kids' art education at a community center, to a church choir, to ethnic festivals, to indigenous culture trails, etc. And so what my firm did in partnership with Forum and the arts and culture stakeholders was to conduct a kind of we call it asset mapping, but that's really just a nerdy way of saying kind of reconnaissance. Try to understand really what people value as arts and culture in their places.
What did you tangibly determine? What were some tangible items that were determined?
Well, we compiled a long but not comprehensive list based on lots and lots of input from people who came to town halls, who answered questionnaires, who talked to us in focus groups, of all of the festivals, the ceremonies, the places that people consider arts and culture. And one thing that rose up very clearly, Esther, from this body of work was that in Northwest Indiana, people don't think about the big A arts when they think about arts in our community. The word that came up again and again and again was community, meaning the proximity of arts and culture, the accessible, small-scale arts and culture that happens in your neighborhood, in your town, in your district. And that's what we really focused on in the plan, not just the big recognizable venues, but this layer of the creative ecosystem.
And then, you know, Larry, to add into that, so as we were looking at this plan and the strategy, we started to identify little things that we could do that were going to enrich that ecosystem, big things that we could do that would be on a much grander scale. But then as we were looking, originally we were like, okay, well, we can put this implementation item into the placemaking pillar, and this one could go into the talent pillar, and this could go into infrastructure. And so as we were kind of massaging it and Philip and his team were doing the work, we realized that there was so much here around arts and culture, and it was so much, there was so much meaning around it that it needed its own pillar. It needed its own space to live and breathe under the Ignite the Region plan, or it was going to get lost again as it had initially when we first did the plan. I mean, we put sprinklings of arts and culture in the strategy, but it was the first regional economic development plan. And as Philip laughs every time I say, but it was, you know, kind of the basic blocking and tackling of an economic development plan. And so when we revamped the strategy and put our big ideas into it, evolving the economy and creating creative culture and creative economy is a critical component to us, but we didn't really have a prescriptive way of how to do that or what that looks like. And so in order for these key components that public sphere projects really helped us to identify, we really felt that it was important to for it to have its own standalone pillar. Both Esther and Larry, I think right. you can agree that arts is so important that we need to call it out in some fashion. And initially when we were looking at this, we maybe weren't giving it the respect that it deserved and giving it its own space to live and breathe.
Plus, Northwest Indiana, as you well know, is a lot different than probably some of the other areas that you've dealt with, Philip. And I know Heather knows this. We are, while we're a population of like anywhere from 700 to maybe almost a million people, depending on the footprint that you look at, it's so diverse. It exists sometimes as little fiefdoms. And I think that some of the experience you may have had is you have all these different art groups and entities where if we were transplanted away from Chicago and onto ourselves and maybe centered around a city, it'd be a lot different. There, you know, even just going next door to South Bend, you could see how that works with South Bend Elkhart. There's a much more center. So how was that different for you, Philip, to address that? I mean, both Esther and I have participated in some of the town halls and the meetings and things like that, but it was a different approach for you.
Well, you're right that it is a unique geographic and cultural region. And to your point about it being clustered around Chicago, I think our research and the data showed pretty clearly that when people want the big A culture, to come back to that, they travel to Chicago to consume that kind of culture. But the ecosystem in the region is actually so much more rich and diverse than that. I've already mentioned, for instance, ethnic festivals. That's a real asset. If you look at it all together, not just as one festival here, one market there, but as an entire year-long program of events, it starts looking like a really big industry in itself. So that was an important insight for us, that there was so many different, it was an intersection of different cultures, cultural practices, and then seen together, it creates a real sort of gravitational pull in the region. And the insight that came sort of midway through the project for us was that rather than looking at all of these cultural practices and activities separately as their own little activity or festival or venue, if we saw it all, if we zoomed out and saw it all as its own cluster of economic activity, of cultural activity, that led us to the conclusion that it deserves its own pillar, right? That not only does arts and culture weave through all of the other goals in the region, its infrastructure, its industry, workforce, attraction, retention, but that seen from that 30,000 foot view, it is its own major driver, the regional character. So I think we didn't start out by thinking of it as its own pillar, its own body of work. But the more we saw it, the more assets we documented, the longer our list grew, the more people we spoke to, the more it became really obvious to us that this is an area of strength for Northwest Indiana.
So this is for either Heather or Philip, whoever feels can answer this best. Who were you identifying as stakeholders and how did you reach out to them? because, you know, I'll pair it with Larry said, you know, we did attend some of the town halls and the other, you know, events, but as I looked over all the information you provided us, I realized I haven't really heard from the organization since that Lubeznik event more than a year ago.
Oh, sure. Well, I can take the first crack at that, but I think Heather should also speak about the way that Forum was able to convene all stakeholders. One thing that stands out to me, it was really striking in this region, is how people self-identified as being part of the arts and culture scene. We did a series of town halls throughout the region, I think four, and, you know, all the way down to Rensselaer, Indiana, and Michigan City, and Gary, et cetera, and spread the word through other arts and cultural organizations, through Forum's channel, and people showed up. And we're talking in the hundreds, all kinds of people, of course, the institutional leaders of nonprofits that you would expect, but also artisans, craftspeople, metallurgists, arts educators, individual musicians, mural makers. And I think they were really waiting for that invitation, Esther. It didn't take in some ways very much to attract the focus, the attention, to focus the desires of the creative sector. Of course, there was labor involved, and maybe Heather can speak a little bit to that.
Yeah, and so, you know, when we started in this area, my naivety around this category was blaring. Like, it was a glare. Like, I know some great people in the arts community, but my bench strength is not deep there. So we really relied heavily on the arts community to help self-propagate things and to help us get folks to the table. And as Philip said, people came out and they came in droves, and, you know, we did different listening tours all around the region and really gathered information, and then had some one-on-one calls with different projects that had been bubbled up initially as potential projects to put on the implementation matrix and what they had going on. And then again, you know, as the strategy continued to roll out, we did surveys from across the region and publicized that and on Facebook and the Times and really got some great community engagement around that as well. You know, everybody's moving fast and furiously. So again, not the market of people that we're typically having day in and day out conversations with, but it's been so fun to get to know new friends and to learn new things from new people. That when we rolled out the draft of the strategy, 2 weeks ago, Philip, we felt the swell of pride from the community that they had been heard, and that they felt that they'd been participated with, and that there were really great things in this strategy. And again, it's a starting point, right? It's certainly not the ending point. This is just the beginning of this walk together as we continue to try and drive change in this sector and in this pillar. So it's been pretty fun and pretty exciting to make new friends, learn more about the industry itself in our area and what assets there are. And again, this is the beginning point. It is certainly not the ending point. So as we continue to build out that implementation matrix, it will be done by the arts community coming together and sitting down at a table and really looking over the things that we're suggesting, but adding more things to it. And so I think that it's an engagement process that is gone. We thought that it was going to be a 3 month deal that, you know, or 3 month, 3 to 4 month deal that we were working on this. And we're on, I think, month 11 right now. So it's been longer and more engagement than we'd anticipated. But I think that it was important to kind of slow down and really get in the process of understanding where the value could be in the sector and what things we were missing and really listening a little bit more closely.
Am I gathering that the money that was appropriated then is sitting someplace while you're developing how to disperse or how to use it, or has it gone toward a certain project at this point?
Let's hope it's earning some interest.
Let's hope.
So dollars are with the IEDC and the Lilly Endowment. And so they have not been the IEDC and the Indiana Arts Commission both realized that as we were asking for projects that maybe we were asking the wrong questions to, the economic development community might have been coming at this with more of an economic development hat on than an arts and culture hat. And so we all slowed down our role a little bit and they're revamping that whole process. So projects that had submit originally to be considered are still in that waiting queue, but we know that there's going to be a new application process that comes out because they really want the communities to have been more mindful than we were being originally around this. And so that's what led them to say, hey, create a strategy around this. Don't come just at it willy-nilly thinking that you know what you don't know. And so then that really lent us to being able to do this a little bit more holistically.
Quickly, we have just about a minute left. One of the proposals, what the implementation, I know there's talk about having a director part of the forum. Some real quick in these last few moments we have.
Yeah, so that, you know, we will put in a submission to Lilly to help bolster that ecosystem by adding some staff to be able to help guide on some of those things. But regardless, even if we don't get those dollars, we've created it as a pillar of Ignite the Region, and we'll have a pillar leader that works with the forum. So it will be somebody from the arts community that will help us to guide that pillar so that it doesn't get lost in the shuffle and that we're not just relying on the funding in order to make these things happen.
That sounds great. Well, we appreciate you coming on the internet. This sounds like a longer conversation that maybe down the road we will check back with both of you and see how we are making progress on it. That's Heather Innes from the Forum, Philip Arish from the PSP Projects. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing that. And I'm sure we'll come back and revisit this as the process goes on.
Yeah, most definitely.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Art of the Year listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show, whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners? Email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
This is Raina Duras, host of World Cafe, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM. And on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are happy to welcome Joey Lax Salinas to Art on the Air. Joey is a photographer, video producer, author, and musician whose photos and videos have been featured on Good Morning America, World News Tonight with Diane Sawyer, The Weather Channel, CNN, Forbes.com, and USA.com. In 2005, he began taking photos of Northwest Indiana with a goal of capturing every city and town during every season and major community events. He accomplished that and has traveled to other cities in the Midwest and beyond. He published his first book in 2023, Goodnight Indiana University, which takes a whimsical journey around the campus. His current book is Sweet Dreams Northwest Indiana. The sun is setting on Northwest Indiana, and it is time for families to say sweet dreams to their favorite places. He will also have a new book in the new year, Fading Ads of Indiana. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Joey. It's very nice meeting you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here today.
Well, Joey, we always want our guests to be able to share their background story. I could say their origin story. How you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Joey.
Sure. So I'm a lifelong region resident. I grew up in Hammond. I'm a graduate from Gavitt High School, which is now closed in Hammond, but I'm a graduate from class of 1999. After Gavitt, I went down to Indiana University. My initial goal going down there wasn't anything related to what I'm doing now. I actually went down there thinking I was going to do political science and maybe get into politics and policy and things like that. That actually changed pretty quickly early on. I'm a real creative person, so just going into politics wasn't going to be the direction that I wanted to go. I found that pretty early on. So I actually pivoted and went towards television production. So my time at Indiana University was spent learning television production, the technical side of it, as well as the business side of it. One of my great experiences that I had down there is during my senior year, I worked with John Mellencamp. So I was a production assistant on a documentary. It was the behind the scenes making. The documentary is called Trouble No More, the making of a John Mellencamp album. And it was the behind the scenes making of an album. So I got to work with him briefly right before I graduated, which was really, really cool. After I left IU, I graduated with a television production degree. I learned all about digital video in a time where digital video hadn't become the standard that is now on YouTube and everything else that we see. So I graduated in 2003. It was 3 years before YouTube came out. So I kind of came out saying, hey, I have all of these digital video skills. What can I do with them now? It wasn't really, there wasn't a platform just to put up your digital video. So I had initially thought that I was going to come and work for one of the TV stations in Chicago, work for ABC or NBC or something like that, and found out the hard way that that they don't want somebody right out of college. They're looking for somebody who came from a smaller market and maybe worked their way up for a couple of years, and unless, of course, I wanted to start as a part-timer doing like grip work or something like that. So after that, I actually became an admissions counselor at a college. So I went that direction and started doing a lot of marketing for them internally while being an admissions counselor. During that time, I ended up going on vacation and picking up a really nice camera. It was my first DSLR camera, a Canon Digital Rebel XT. This was 2005. And went to Las Vegas on a trip. And I came back. I took a lot of photos. I posted them on Facebook and MySpace, which was really popular back then. It was right when Facebook had come out. And I believe I had two people that reached out to me, and they were like, hey, I love this picture of the strip. Can I license this picture? Maybe I'll pay you something. I want to make some keychains out of it. So they ended up purchasing a picture from me, and that kind of gave me the idea of, hey, I could maybe I could do something. I could sell some pictures, and I could sell them digitally if I'm not actually selling photographs. And so it just kind of snowballed from there. So for the first year or two, anytime I would go anywhere, I would take my camera, of course, and I would take pictures and I would post them. And I started taking local pictures of the region. So you know, I'm from Hammond, and I was living in Hammond at the time, and I would go down to Crown Point and Munster and Highland and Sherrillville and just everywhere in the region, and I would take pictures of the welcome signs. That kind of snowballed into what else can I do for some of these towns, and including my own town. So it ended up being a much bigger project that I turned it into, where it started from welcome signs, and then it turned into capturing the landmarks and all the points of interest in all of these towns and the historic downtowns, and just really snowballed. Then I wanted to do it in all the different seasons. So then I'm recapturing the same locations, but I'm doing it in the wintertime and in the fall time. And so it was a passion project that started when I was at Indiana University, and I would tell people I was from Hammond, Indiana, and they would say, oh yeah, all those steel mills up there. And we're kind of familiar with Hammond. And their impression of it was that it was a gritty city. And so I knew really what it was. I knew that there was a beach in Hammond. There was a lot of really cool parks and trails and different things to do. So that really catapulted my photography for Northwest Indiana and for local photography, and wanting to show off Hammond the way that I saw it. And I wanted to share that with people that I went to school with and people that aren't from the area. And it just kind of went from there, really.
So I'd like to kind of go back to elementary school almost. And what your artistic, you know, was photography present in the household? I mean, was it, did you have a family that loved to take pictures and videos? I'm just,
no,
because it's very interesting that you said like it all kind of happened at that certain point at IU, and going in there, you weren't even, you know, headed in this direction, but I'm kind of wondering whether it was.
Sure. So earlier on, I didn't really have any kind of media experience between photos or videos before, I'd say, the early 90s. Right around 1991, 1992, my parents bought their first video camera. It was our first family home video camera. I was about 10 years old. I think it was 1991. And I remember there was a couple very, very like rudimentary effects that were built into this camera. And it was like a Sony Handycam something or whatever. It was right when the smaller versions came out before the over-the-shoulder ones had already gone off the shelves. And so I remember I could write something in marker on a piece of paper and take a picture of it with the camera and then create a negative, which essentially created like a CGI effect. And so I would videotape people playing basketball and I would have like a fake score at the bottom or something, just like when they popped up the score when somebody would make a basket. Sure. So this is 1994 maybe or something. I mean, very rudimentary. I mean, when I look back at it now, you have to laugh at it now at this point. But
I still enjoy my Super 8 movies that I made back in high school. So.
Sure, it was a lot of fun. And I also have two sisters, Roseanne and Rachel. And so we're all pretty close in age and we had two dogs at the time. And I remember one time going out and trying to film a movie about them and where one dog meets the other one. It was almost like a love story where they fall in love. And it was just, you know, things like that. And so I was always really into that. And I was always into graphic art when graphic art started becoming, or digital art started becoming popular on computers like in the mid 90s. So when Photoshop first came out, I don't know if I had the very first version of Photoshop. It was probably after that, but there was a couple other programs that were watered down versions of graphic arts programs. And I really, really liked those. And so I would make silly graphics. I would draw our family. I would just draw a funny picture of something that happened in our family. And I would actually just draw it out like in a paint program and just things like that. So I was always really, really creative with that type of stuff. I didn't get into actual video editing until probably my freshman year when I was in college. I just kind of started doing it on my own. This would have been 1999. It was right when you can start getting some digital programs and using some very basic digital programs. And so I started doing that, and that's my freshman year. I mean, thank goodness I found out really early that that's what I wanted to do. But I was like, hey, this is really cool. And you know, the heck with political science, I'm going to go into video production. I'm going to do something that's going to be fun and creative and that changes every day and that, you know, I can kind of create my own stories and stuff. So that was kind of the basis behind it. But nobody in the family was a photographer. Nobody was a videographer. My mom is pretty creative. She can draw. She can draw in color. And so we would draw in color and stuff like that when I was younger. But as far as using technical equipment, not really, not until that family home video camera showed its face right around 1991.
Oh, excellent. Well, so I just wanted to, okay, so you're from Hammond, but you didn't go to IUN, you went to Bloomington then?
I went to Bloomington.
That makes sense then with the John Mellencamp
yes.
connection.
Right. Yes.
Well, and so it sounds like then when you picked up your Canon Rebel that you were actually untrained in using in terms of still photography. So, and that's okay because you can be self-taught and actually sometimes you don't have to bring with you a whole bunch of luggage when you do that. You can learn it really fast, but tell us about your development as a photographer as you pick that up and, you know, obviously you start shooting and then eventually say, hey, I discovered RAW.
Yeah. So, fortunately, you know, I was video trained when I was down at school and there's so many similarities between video and photo production, you know, photos. Of course the editing process is different, but, the technicalities of aperture and, things like that, shutter speed. So I had a lot of that training already, as a baseline as I went out and started shooting my photos. I went out and started shooting my first photos. I shot some terrible stuff. I mean, you know, I was using a digital camera and I was blowing out my highlights. I was doing all the wrong things. And then I got into HDR, and then I started really just kind of getting heavy into that. And I look back at them now and I my eyes burn when I look back at some of my early work. It's, you know, it's, you know, I hope that none of it's online anywhere. If I have control of anything online, I try and remove it. But, you know, it was just a time where HDR programs started becoming prevalent, and some people started taking it to the extreme, and some things look really neat and some things just really look blown out. And I was kind of all over the spectrum, just experimenting. And, you know, as I look through my work now, you know, I don't go anywhere near that extreme. I don't even really do HDR stuff unless I really have to, if I'm in a really dynamic situation where I have a lot of low lights and highlights mixed together. But as my work, evolved, you know, I would say my first 5 years of photography was really experimental. So, 2005 through 2010, I was capturing local stuff. I wasn't doing the HDR stuff with that. I was mainly doing it with like landscape stuff, really cool shots of the dunes or something that I might try and blow out, or not really pictures of downtowns or whatever. But so that developed until, I don't know, 2011 or so. I started getting away from doing the HDRs. It started burning my eyes too much that I just moved away from it, and got into really clean photography, and just really focused on sharpness and tonal values and things like that. Having really balanced photos as opposed to just really hyper vibrant, colorful, poppy type of stuff. So so that was also right around the time that I started doing a lot of Northwest Indiana stuff. So Hammond is my hometown. Again, when I was down at IU, I wanted to really kind of convey that Hammond was a cool place. And so I was always telling people about that. So I used Hammond as my canvas. I was living in Hammond and in Schererville at the time, between 2005 and 2010. So I moved to Schererville, I think, in 2007, but I still continued going to Hammond and taking a lot of pictures. So from like 2010 to 2014 or so, I really focused on Hammond a lot. And Hammond was my hometown. I really wanted people to have a positive image of what Hammond was. And of course, I branched out to Crown Point and Valparaiso and some of the other towns too. But it was really all about Hammond. And in 2014, I reached out to Mayor McDermott, who's still mayor in Hammond. And I wanted to donate a lot of the photos that I took to the city of Hammond. And so I wanted to donate these digital versions that they could use in their marketing, that they can use on the websites, that they can use in flyers, brochures, anything like that that they were making. So it was just a collection of really nice pictures of Hammond. And so we had a meeting in his office, and he was like, man, these are really awesome. Like, why are you doing this? And I kind of told him the story, the same one that I just told you. And I wanted to really improve the image of Hammond. And so I also told him I was doing the same thing for Gary and for some of the surrounding cities, that I really wanted to kind of create this positive image. And I also knew that there was a market for this. So from a business side, there was no place to buy a photo of Hammond. If you were a business in Hammond and you were building a website, you either had to go and take it, find somebody that had a photo and ask them if you can use it. But there wasn't like a centralized location, like a stock photo library, so to speak. And it literally just became my mission to create that, and to do that not only for Hammond, but for all of Northwest Indiana. So that was that time period right there.
Well, you're listening to our guest today, Joey Lax Salinas, on Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
Well, I want to talk about, I guess, Sweet Dreams right now. So the illustrations in them are very colorful and delightful. What did you know you wanted to go with illustrations rather than photography when you did this book? And I don't recall, are there actually the photos of all those places in the index?
So the photos themselves aren't, they're not in the index of the book, but they are all based on my photography. So all of the illustrations are based on my photography. This is actually my second book. So my first book is Goodnight Indiana University. So when I did that book, I actually found an illustrator. The way I did that, I actually looked online and I found a website that had a whole bunch of illustrators from all around the world. And I found, I think, three or four different illustrators, and I sent them all the exact same photo. It was a photo of the sample gates down at Indiana University. And two of them came back and they were pretty good. And one of them came back and it just blew me away. So it ended up being the cover of the book. So as I worked with him, I mean, he was just fantastic to work with. And when I did the IU book, I initially wanted to target children and alumni that now had children. So people like myself, I'm an alumni. I have an almost 7-year-old and a 3-year-old. So people that are just like me that are super proud of IU, that want to show their kids about it and want to like take their kids to the campus and stuff. And like, I know the feeling that I get, and I know that there's tons of other people and alumni that feel the same way. So that was my initial feeling. After the book came out, I realized that a lot of parents were buying this for their kids who just graduated. So it wasn't necessarily a children's book. It was a book that was just more of a keepsake about Indiana University, which was great.
A bit of nostalgia.
So, exactly. It was a bit of nostalgia. Alumni themselves, because these illustrations were based exactly on my photography, the illustrations are all proportional. Everything is to scale and to size because they're literally tracings of my work. So after that, and after kind of seeing that this is beyond a children's book, this is a book for anybody that loves the IU campus. It could be a coffee table book. It could be anything. As I was thinking out the whole Sweet Dreams Northwest Indiana book, I kept that in mind too. I didn't want to make it just for children. I wanted to make it really vibrant and colorful. It really stands out on the shelves. So that's one of the things that retailers said, as I talked to them down in Bloomington, was like, hey, let's make this really vibrant for Northwest Indiana. And, that's kind of why I stuck with that theme.
Very beautiful.
Yeah. So tell us about your upcoming project you're working on, and also any other video production that you're involved with.
Sure. So I have a couple projects coming up. My next one is a book. So this one is not necessarily for children. So this one's called Fading Ads of Indiana. It documents 180 ghost signs that are from around the state of Indiana. So they call them ghost signs. They're really faded advertisements. Some are old Coca-Cola signs, Pepsi. There's a lot of tobacco ads, male pouch tobacco. That one's really popular. Gold Medal Flower, that's another popular one. So it documents a lot of these ghost signs, as well as the companies that have now been defunct for decades. So it goes down the rabbit hole. And it covers Northwest Indiana. So we have, I think there's two or three signs from Hammond. There's six or seven from Gary. So it covers, I don't remember the exact amount of cities that are in the book, but it's really documenting those advertisements. And a lot of them are culturally significant to those towns. They're local hardware stores that the town used to center around. And so that's really cool. That's going to be out March 24th. And that's, I think, the eighth book in a series. So there's also a book about Chicago and Philadelphia and New York City. So this is the only one that covers an entire state. So Indianapolis wasn't big enough to cover just Indianapolis. So we did the entire state of Indiana.
So how far have you gone? Because you said Midwest and beyond. So how far beyond have you traveled?
I've been to 43 states, so there's only seven I haven't been to, Hawaii and Alaska being two of those. I haven't been to the far Northwest, so I haven't been to Washington and Oregon, and I haven't been to the deep South, so I haven't been to, like, Louisiana and Mississippi, and that's pretty much it. But I've certainly been all around Indiana. I've been covering, now, you know, my Northwest Indiana photos went way beyond that. I'm doing every photo or every city and town in the entire state of Indiana. So I'm at about 430 municipalities now that I've covered, and I've documented them all. I've put them in a stock photo collection. So if you're from Southern Indiana, Central Indiana, I have you covered. The only towns that I have left are, pretty much like no stoplight towns.
I know one, and I don't know if you got it, is the red gold silo that's just off of I-65, like mile marker 19. I don't know if you saw that. That's kind of a fading issue. I know I've stopped, and one time I was driving, and I kind of pulled off the expressway quick. My wife, what are you doing? I said, I always wanted to shoot that. So, yeah.
Sure, sure. So I know of that one. I wish I had that one in the book. I don't have it. I do have a really cool mail pouch tobacco one that's as you go into Flora, Indiana. So it's somewhere like between Monticello and Flora, and it's really, really cool. It's right off the road, and it was apparently covered with siding for a long time, and they took the siding off a couple years ago. And so it's in great condition when you look at it, and when the sun hits it just right, it's just beautiful.
For our photographer friends, and we only got about 2 minutes left here, tell us about the equipment you are now using for your photography.
Sure. So I'm using a Canon 5D Mark IV. I have one of those. I have multiple lenses. I have a telephoto lens and other stuff. I have a concert lens that I use. And yeah, I mean, I also do video footage and different little video productions with my Canon 5D Mark IV. So I'll have a video series that I'm actually working on right now. I'm developing right now, talking about, it's like takes you on like 15 minute stories of just something that's interesting, like stories that need to be told. And they might be about a ghost sign or something else. And so I'm really looking forward to being able to share that. That'll be sometime probably in the spring. I've got 4 episodes already that I filmed and I've edited, and I want to make it about a series of 12. So I'm looking for more interesting stories that are untold. So I'm working on that right now.
In our final moments here, tell us your website and any things. We only got about 30 seconds left.
Sure. So my website is just my name, joeylaxsalinas.com. If you want to see the Indiana photos, the best way to go is to indianaphotos.com. That's the best way. It'll take you to the hub. It's divided up into northern, central, southern, and northwest Indiana. And you can drill down by each city alphabetically. So it's really easy to navigate.
Fantastic. Well, we appreciate you coming on there, Joey Laxalinas, and you can do that by his website search on there. Photographer from Northwest Indiana, also videographer. Sweet Dreams, Northwest Indiana is his newest introduction to us, and they'll be doing books signings all over Northwest Indiana in the upcoming days. Thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air and sharing your arts and photography journey.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's been completely delightful. Thank you.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art in the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts, give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through art.
show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world.